Welcome to the podcast of the European Society of Anesthesiology and Intensive Care. I'm your host today. My name is Dr. Andrei Barvinsky from Torbay and South Devon Healthcare NHS Trust in Turkey, United Kingdom. And today we will be speaking about fiber optic intubation, keeping it simple. And for that, we have invited Professor Eleanor O'Sullivan from St. James Hospital in Dublin, Ireland, to be our expert on this very important topic from any of our viewers across Europe and beyond. Welcome, Ellen.
I'm delighted to be here, Andy.
Thank you very much. I have prepared quite a few questions for you today so we can discuss them. And as I'm sure the listeners would really very much like to hear your personal view on this very important topic. So my first question is, in your very long career in our specialty in anesthesiology, what was the type of surgical list where you would normally perform the most of your fiber optic intubations?
I suppose I've always had an interest in airway management, so I have gravitated towards head and neck ENT lists. And when I worked in Liverpool, I was in the Aintree University Teaching Hospital, where we had a major head and neck unit and maxillofacial unit. And similarly, now I'm in Dublin in Ireland. I'm in the largest head and neck centre in the country. We also do have a regional maxillofacial centre, which does a lot of head and neck and trauma. And we also have a burns unit. So I suppose I'm very lucky in that I do have the opportunity to do to manage a lot of difficult airways, and as a result, have had a lot of experience in awake tracheal intubation.
Very similar to lots of us, including myself. I also do regular maxillofacial lists, and we share this list with a colleague who does lots of ENT. So we sometimes crisscross specialties to actually keep the interest going. Okay, and what were the main indications for awake fiber optic intubations in your practice?
I mean, I'll give a statement that we put in our guidelines from 2019 saying that awake tracheal intubation must always be considered in the presence of predictors of difficult airway management, okay? So that's a very broad statement, but I mean, it must always, always be considered. And in 2022, I don't know if you know, we redid the ASA guidelines, yeah, actually. And I was lucky enough to be the first non-American on, one of the first non-American groups on those guidelines. And they have a very, very nice, therefore anticipated and unanticipated, unlike the DAS guidelines. But they have a lovely, the best thing about them, I think, is their decision tree, which is part one of their guidelines. And that decision tree kind of almost says the same thing, but that you have to think about if it's a difficult, anticipated difficult airway, do you suspect difficulty with mass ventilation? Do you suspect, yeah, difficulty with supraglottic placement? Do you suspect difficulty with aspiration, or significant risk of aspiration and increased risk of rapid desaturation, for instance, in an obese patient? So you should always consider it and have a good reason for not doing it. Yeah. And I think this is so important, because if you go back to NAP4, and that looked at major problems related to airway management, there were 18 cases in NAP4 which came to harm. So they either died or had morbidity or needed front and neck. And those cases, when they look back, because that's what they did in NAP4, they looked at all these cases in detail, they should have had an awake fiber optic intubation. So I think we don't do it enough. And we also know from audits of this that we don't do enough awake fiber optic intubation.
I totally agree. I think in NAP4, it showed that people, in some of those cases, people actually thought of doing that but never implemented. And it's partly because they didn't have enough experience with it, so it was a big deal for them to do. So I always say, if you have an intention to do it, just do it, you know, because you're not actually losing anything. You're not cutting any roads. You're not stopping anything by doing it. You know, patients are still awake, they're breathing, so that's fine. So when you talk to the patient about the possible awake fiber optic intubation, when you consent them, what do you actually tell them?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because I have this view that a lot of people say then they don't do awake tracheal intubation because patients won't like it. Patients are nervous. And I and my trainee might come along and say, I don't think this patient will have. And I say, it's about the consent, isn't it? It's about talking to the patients. Obviously, you have to tell them that there is a leaflet which DAS has on the website you can give them to read. But lots of patients don't read those and they're a bit nervous, or even if they have read them, want to chat to you. So you have to discuss it with the patient. And I think you have to frame it in the sense that you tell them exactly what you're going to do. And but also, I think I do say to some patients, we have to do this technique. It's the safest technique for you. I do a lot of them. They are nervous. You have to give them the confidence that you have done them and that you're competent in doing them and that they're safe and that, you know, you'll be monitoring them and so forth. But I think this business, if they're nervous, you have to reassure them and not give them false reassurance, but tell them what the bits that are a bit uncomfortable. And we also have now actually just recently done a video in our department. There are videos available that you can watch. And remember, everybody has iPhones now with them, pre-op. So you can give them the video that's available from DAS if you haven't done one. But in our department, we've done one now, bespoke to our hospital, our theatre. So they see exactly how we do them. So that can help. We've just literally done that recently. But I really think it's important that we reassure the patients because, you know, when I do these, patients are very, very nervous about being away.
Yeah, they are.
And I ask them, have they had a gastroscopy? And they say, oh, yes, yes. And did you have sedation for that? Yes. A little bit of discomfort in the mouth. And I say, it's the same thing, but you don't see gastroenterologists saying, you have an option, you know, you can do your wake or sleep. I don't give the option to the patients if I've decided they need an awake intubation. And I do obviously say, if we may have to put you to sleep for this procedure, for this surgery.
Yeah,
how do you do it, Andre?
Well, interestingly, you mentioned the video. We have recorded this video a while ago, about in 2004. It's now available on the YouTube. And the short version of like 7 minutes, and then the long version for the specialist with all the indication and everything. It's a bit outdated, but it's still, the main principle is still the same. So sometimes I let them actually watch that video on my YouTube channel. It's not available, but I tell them that the main thing we're doing that, so you continue your breathing. And I say the alternative to that, we're either doing that, or because your airway is so difficult, I'll have to do a front of the neck access. Would you rather have that, or I'll do this way? It may be a bit uncomfortable when I spray, you may cough and things like that, but it's what I'm trying to avoid, not actually going through your neck. And suddenly the understanding and the attention is suddenly there. They're like, oh, yeah, please do that, doctor. That sounds a lot better suddenly, you know? So you get to give them the alternative why you're doing that, trying to avoid slash at their neck open. Things like that. Okay, let's move on to the technique itself. Well, I have been asked this question so many times by various colleagues and trainees. Do you use antithyalagogue premedication routinely in your practice to dry secretions? Is it worth it? And if so, what should be the optimal timing for such premedication?
I never use antithyalagogue. So no, I don't think it's necessary. I think it's uncomfortable for the patient and it does give a nervous patient even more of a tachycardia. Yeah. So answer is no. And I would say, in all the years I've been doing this, and maybe the very beginning we had, there was consultants who used to use it. I think the move has been away from you routinely using it. And you have to give it a bit in advance as well, obviously. But you can't just give it and expect it to work. When you're in the operating theatre, you have to give it at least half an hour to 40 minutes in advance. So answer is no.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we used to like, oh, give it IM or give it IV, and then you have to wait, and then it doesn't work. And then it worked an hour later when the whole thing is over. So it's absolutely pointless actually doing that. And you're right, it all causes tachycardia and undue distress. So do you start a bit of sedation before you start anesthetizing the airway or not? How do you
It's a kind of a simultaneous process because, again, I think I don't like this myth that to delay the surgery and the surgeon goes, oh, my God, you're doing an awake. We actually have it down. You can do it very quickly. It does not delay, actually, the start of the procedure for us because we do a fair few of them, but also because the setup is there, we have a checklist, okay? And the checklist is done in advance before a patient comes anywhere near the operating theatre. Okay, so we go through it, what we need and what the assistant needs. And we do the ergonomic setup of where the screen would be and everything. So once the patient comes into the theatre, I start the IV in, and then I start the sedation, which we can talk about in a minute. Yep. But I also then start the topicalization. So it's all simultaneous, but I don't delay to wait for the sedation to work. I start the topicalization. I at this usually have the patient sitting up at this point, and I'm eye contact and just telling them everything I'm doing. So it's kind of simultaneously.
Yeah, it is. I usually prefer, because lots of people just start doing topicalization and then start sedation. And I think topicalization itself is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So I actually start running sedation just before I start, training into the airway, because that makes the whole thing a little bit more comfortable for them. Okay. So just before we go to sedation, let's just touch upon oxygen, because how do you administer oxygen during the procedure?
What I should say was I start the IV and I start the oxygen. We always give oxygen. It's important. It's one of the essential components of a weight tracheal intubation. We use a lot of high-flow nasal oxygen. The study came out from Imran Ahmed's group in 2015, not long after Anil Patel's paper, on looking at using high flow in a very difficult cohort of head and neck type cases that he does. And it showed categorically that it improved oxygenation. There were, I think, 14 patients in that study who started off with very quite low saturations. In fact, post-procedure, they were higher post-intubation. Mm-hmm. So high flow nasal is essential in, I'd say, the more difficult cases. It's essential in the stridorous patients. It is absolutely essential in the stridorous patients, or patients with abscesses and things, or the predicted are going to be difficult to wait for fibroptic. Now, when I'm doing fractured mandibles with a weight tracheal intubation, or maybe the less severe abscesses, I may not, just because of cost and it may be being used, but always use oxygen though. So nasal oxygen, we just put nasal cannula or high flow, definitely one or the other. We used to kind of use oxygen in a kind of a sponge nostril at one point, but we've stopped doing that because, as I say, even with the nasal oxygen, you can go down along the side and keep it on while you're doing it. Some people put a bit of tape on the other prong. But I think with the nice nasal prongs we've now, you don't need to take it off. So definitely oxygen. Give oxygen, but high flow, and particularly if you're teaching as well, I must admit, if I have a fairly junior registrar, because we have to teach them in our SHO registrars, because they see these patients on call, the abscess and things they have to do, the wake fiber optics. So we do teach quite junior people. We always put high flow on then, just to buy us a bit more time when they're taking maybe a little bit longer to intubate.
Absolutely. It's a game changer, isn't it, oxygen? We used to use the oxygen catheter with a sponge. We called it nodding nasal oxygenation during induction. But the problem there is dry oxygen. You cannot give more than 5 liters per minute on the awake patient and then 15 when they're asleep. As with a humidified and warm air, it can go to 70%, and your apneic window obviously goes longer and longer and longer. You're a bit more relaxed. You know, they don't desaturate. You can take your time. It's a lot more comfortable. And also, go for it.
Yeah, I just want to add the stridorous patient though, because I did before high flow, you worried about those patients so much and you gave them the noddy. But since high flow, the first thing I do even before I put an IV in is we put them on high flow. When I'm getting a call at night to say, come in, there's a stridor in the A&E, they're bringing him up to theatre, I say, put on the high flow. And it reduces, it's the one group you can put it on to like 70 litres. They seem to reduce the work of breathing. They seem to tolerate it, and it relaxes them. So it is a different patient almost when you've given them the high flow, because I think they're getting some oxygen in. So if you learn one thing from this webinar, is give high flow to those patients and then proceed, but make sure they're comfortable with the high flow.
I've introduced our high flow oxygen in our hospital maybe 8 years ago. We have now 3 units. We got them everywhere, and it's just been such a game changer. and they're getting less and less expensive for different companies producing them. So every unit should have it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the anesthetizing the airway in preparation for awake abrupt intubation. What do you start with, and what's your recipe for topicalization?
Again, everybody's different recipes, but over the years, mine has evolved and it kind of gets simpler, essentially. But for topicalization, I tend to use a sprays as I go technique. So I start, most of mine are nasal. If you have a choice of oral nasal, I would say always go nasal. It splints your scope. It's an easier technique, an easier approach to the airway. So I would do mostly nasal, but there's obviously times where you have to do an oral one. So I start with the nose. I use cofenolcane spray to the nostril, having a pre-op assessed which nostril seems to be the best. If or you can even do it with your scope before you start. But I usually have a good idea which one I'll use. And I tend to just prepare one nostril because I want to kind of give maximum spray to that nostril. At this point, before I started, I've written down the weight of the patient and I've worked out that there's a maximum dose of local anesthetic I can give, just 9 milligrams per kilogram, which is a study that came from bronchoscopy list, but it's the only work out there. So 9 milligrams per kilogram lean body mass. Then I spray the anterior nostril. It's a bit stingy, the cofenolcane, but again, I've explained this to the patient. And as you say, there's a bit of sedation on board, but it's not too bad. They kind of get used to it. Then I gradually move up to the back of the nares and I'm generous. I am generous with that. I give 6 to 8 in most adults. You can be generous with that. And it just trickled to the back of the air, which I say to the patient, you get a little bit of taste in the back of your tongue. But, you know, they kind of cough it a little bit. In addition, I always have, you talked about antisalivants. If people have secretions or if they are the bit striders, the first thing I do also is just clear the back of the airway. And I have a suction, large anchor sucker at the edge there. Give them a tissue. I say, just cough, because that'll make them kind of spit it out a bit. And if they've lost secretions because they have difficult airway, the pathology there, I have in the past put a little bit of saline in and just cleared that with suction. You know, with a bit of bleeding into the airway. So remember, you can't dry the secretions, but you can get rid of them. You can get them to cough them out. At this point, they're coughing. So I do the nose first, and then I do the airway by I use the mucosal atomizer device.
Yep.
Which is widely available, but look, there was times when we couldn't get that. So otherwise, just the spray, the 10%, on the spray, that works well too. So whichever. Because atomizer spray is lovely because it's got a little memory. Yes. We've seen them. They've got a kind of memory. They go right to the back of the tonsil and to the kind of glottic area. And in fact, you can go right back to the glottis with that.
Yeah.
I use 10% with that spray. And so I fold with the MAD device, the mucosal atomizer device, I use 4% and draw it up into the syringe.
Mm-hmm.
And with the metered spray with the glottis, I use about 10 sprays. I'm generous. And using about 8 of the cofenolcane, which also has acetylphenylephrine and
With the first, with the cofenolcane, it's mainly about phenylephrine, isn't it? Because you want to basically constrict there. You don't want to cause the bleeding, because that part in the nose where people tend to kind of like, oh, this is the not such important part. I want to go there first, you know, and they cause bleeding. And then if the bleeding occurs, then, you know, it's a lot more difficult. You're right about the nostril, because there was a study showing that in 70% people, apparently the right nostril is larger than the left nostril. So by default, I go to the right nostril. And then the sniffing test, I never believed in that. When if you really want to find out, you need to have a look first with the scope to find out which one is larger. You kind of preempted my question about the MAD, which is great, because the mucosalization device, which I think is the best device ever, not just for fiber optic, but also for the awake video laryngoscopic intubation. It's a great device. It's got a memory. Like you said, it's fantastic. So let's talk about sedation. What do you use for sedation? Is it one agent, two agents, combination, or how do you approach that?
Just a plug here for our guidelines, because I think they're very good, because they're simple. They're the only guidelines I think working for awake to clean intubation. But I was mentioning there was a good group of us in the guideline, and we said, what do we all do? So I was always in favor of kind of one agent, but everybody else said maybe two. Some people were doing three and four agents, you know, with a bit of Midaz, a bit of Propofol, a bit of Remy, a bit of Mitomidine. So I think actually what we say in the guideline is keep it to a minimal. You know, one is best, but if you want to add a little bit extra, just be careful. One is best because sedation is, we have a kind of, we say it's a small S. It's not essential. And I have done lots of cases where sedation is not essential for successful awake-to-heal intubation. And most of the problems that occurred in those patients that we saw in NAP4 were over sedation. And in the Danish database study, which they looked at awake-to-heal intubations, over sedation, you know, patient gets hypoxic, you're into problems, you do a quick GA and you're into problems, or you lose the airway. So I think it's very important to keep sedation safe. So remifentanil, as an anaesthetist, I'm very familiar with using. A lot of us are using Teva now. So I use remi at 2 to 4 nanograms per mil. So a TCI. I always use TCI because you know what your level is. 2 to 4. I go up to 5 maybe in a fractured mandible in a big guy who's been fighting and alcoholic or something like that. So you can go up to 5, but 2 to 4 does the trick. It's antitussive. I think people forget that. Remy stops, the reflexes. You will not cough at the larynx point level anyway if you have Remy on board. So I love it from that point of view. And patients seem to, I mean, they probably don't get the amnesia, but they come back and back in my practice. We have a lot of repeat candidates for this, yeah. Back for further surgeries. And they never seem to mind going back and having another awake-to-heal intubation. And the fact that people say, oh, it's horrid. It isn't, in fact. I think it's horrid sometimes for the practitioner if they're not used to doing them, but not for the patients. They do come back. But one agent, it would be Remy. If you don't have it, which we discuss maybe sometimes, dexmedetomidine has come in now. In places where they have it, they love it as well. I don't think it gives the antitussive effect, but I think it seems to be a nice sedative agent. It's slower. And I have this idea, I don't want to put all the time too much in anaesthetic rooms because our surgeons, in fairness to them, are busy. And if you're, every time you do an awake, if it's a half an hour or longer, I think we shouldn't mind, but I think we do. So basically, just to say that dexmedetomidine is fine if you're used to it. Adding a tiny bit of midazolam maybe. If I have a very nervous patient, I might give it early before I kind of start everything, a few milligrams, just so that maybe there's a bit of amnesia for that bit. But I don't kind of give a small amount. And adding it later on is bad news. If you have a good 4 nanograms per mil in and you add even the smallest amount of midaz, you can lose the airway. And then the other thing is propofol infusion. Some people like a bit of that. Again, it's complicated. Have another person watching the sedation. Have another person watching the saturation. Because when you're intent on doing your scoping, you forget about the sedation. You're not really watching the saturations. So we suggest in the guidelines, really have another anaesthetist if you can, maybe more junior person watching. I mean, there's always people want to learn. So I call another trainee into the room and say, you watch sedation and learn much what we're doing.
So, absolutely. Absolutely. We made it like a little policy in our department that if you're doing awake fiber optic intubation, there should be an anaesthetist providing anaesthesia because you will be the proceduralist. You'll be concentrating on procedure. It's like the surgeon doing the operation and the anaesthetic at the same time, which, you know, dentist used to do at some point in the past, which obviously ended up in disaster. Okay. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. When it comes to fiber optic scope, what do you use today? Is it reusable? Is it single use?
That's a very, very good question because I think we're at the point where we've kind of moved over, I suppose, since COVID to a lot of disposable equipment. So, I love the Ambu scopes. They're available everywhere. They're immediately available with a nice screen. They are improving maybe, but they are not my first go choice for difficult airways. And I stress this, they are not. The bendable part is a bit flippy. And I think it's hard. I'd be interested in your experience. It's hard to go through lesions or to go around lesions or pathology. So basically, we seem to keep our reusable, sorry, rather than disposable, I should have said they're disposable. We keep our reusable for the difficult cases. And we use the disposable, as you said, for the kind of everyday max facts where there's no pathology there, and they work fine. But they're not, and we've shown this numbers of times, they're not as good in pathology and in maneuverability because the tip flips back against a lesion. It is a problem also using the disposables because they are, where do you put them all? We are a huge department. We do thoracic as well. And we have, I'm not sure where they all go to, but we're using an awful lot of disposable scopes. And I worry about it from an environmental point of view. And now there is an issue. We've recently bought a lot of new stored scopes. I shouldn't mention a name, but they break, and that is a problem. And that's something we're addressing at the present.
Yeah. There are pros and cons, isn't there? We've used reusable scopes for years and years. There is a bit of a process to setting them up, isn't it? You need to put the white balance, you need to put the orientation mark on the right spot, you need to do the focus, you need all this checked before. It's not quite ready. As the single use, you just plug in and it's ready, ready to go. So in the emergency, sometimes it is better. So we have them on the emergency trolley and a lot of other areas, but we still keep, like you said, we still keep the reusable scopes for really difficult, cases. So there are many other companies which are now pursuing both routes. So that's interesting to exchange views on that. And do you have your preferred endotracheal tube that you load on your scope? Is there any kind that you really like the best?
Yeah. I really like your Flexometallic, you know, the reinforced tubes. And for a number of reasons. First of all, they have a nice slim cuff. If you look at the cuff, it's a nice slim cuff. They are a nice length. They have a soldered connector at the top, I think it's good because that can come off in some of the others. And they're soft, and they're soft in the nose, and they're a nice length. Now, you'll say, why aren't you using the intubating LMA tubes? We do have them. We do use them. I think for the long, some of the minor long cases, I don't like, the soft tip is lovely for going down. It's a kind of silicone tip, and it's nice on your scope because it's very close. You don't have the gap. And it's a bit like a Parker Flex tube, which we don't have, but they have a beak that hugs the scope nicely so you don't get caught in the arytenoids. But the problem with the intubating LMA, they do have, the top does come off them. They're a bit short. And as I said, they're harder to get now as well because we're not using intubating LMAs anymore. We can get them separately. And recently they've stopped making the disposable ones and they're all reusable, which is interesting, but we tend not to reuse those tubes. In fact, you can autoclave them. So what I would say is really that's our first goal. When we're doing the max facts, they tend to like the nasal blue line tubes. They're quite nice, but I wouldn't put one on without cutting it. They're too long on the scope and can affect your maneuveral ability. So we cut them just beyond the curve at that point. But then be careful there on the forehead. So you have to kind of pad them. We put a little bit of a nice soft sponge on them then. But they're the tubes will be used mostly. I think that's it. And the Flexometallic come in every size, so 6 or 7.
Yeah.
They're the tubes we use.
Fantastic. And what do you vary the size of the tube between men and women, or you?
6 mainly. A very big guy, we might use a 7. But the bigger the better, in fact. With the striatus patients, I still use 6. You tend to be able to get 6 in most of those patients.
Brilliant. I've stopped differentiating now. I think 6 works best for everybody. It fits nicely, snugly on the scope, because sometimes when you use 6.5 or 7, it kind of wobbles a bit around the scope. So I think 6 suits the best. I use the blue Rhino tube for all my max packs because it's nicely pointing up. Yeah. And then if it's really difficult cases, I use the tube that comes with the intubating laryngeal mask because of the what I call the pencil point tip, isn't it, of that tube, almost like a pencil point needle, a spinal needle. It just really flies nicely in my opinion. That's my sort of little thing. Okay. And in your experience, what do you think, what is the most uncomfortable part for the patient? Because most novices think it is actually passing the scope or tube by the vocal cord. No. Do you agree with that?
The nose. Yeah. When you're putting the tubes through the nose, they kind of scrunch up their eyes. What I say is, close your eyes. We're just going to do it's going to be a little bit uncomfortable. And I kind of do it in one movement, not fast, but kind of a quick movement, because it's very hard to, it's the pressure, it's not pain, it's not, you've got lots of vasoconstriction and lignocaine there, it's the pressure. So I just say, close your eyes now. And I think, as you say, 6-2 is better too, rather than a 7 from that point of view. And that little bit, but I explain in advance, there'll be a little bit of discomfort when you're railroading the tube.
Yeah. It is a railroading the tube, which is, lots of people worry, oh, it goes through my vocal cords, I'll be popping like mad. And, you know, if you anesthetize them well, they'll be absolutely fine. So it is the nose, be wary of that. And just take your time when you're railroading that tube, warn the patient that this will be uncomfortable. Have you ever decided to abandon the weight fiber optic intubation and chosen the alternative way to secure the airway?
Interesting. I haven't abandoned it, but I have maybe changed route. Or one of my favorite things to, which is underdone, I think, and I really think people should learn this first because it's easier. Putting a wake tracheal intubation, as we call it, rather than a wake fiber optic, you can do with a VL. So I have changed to a VL. But I'll talk about that in a minute. But I've also changed to a superglottic airway device. You've anesthetized the airway. You and I, if we just spray our throats, could put in a superglottic now. And you can intubate nicely through superglottic because you won't be getting lost in trainees at the beginning, particularly like it, because it won't get lost in the airway, particularly if they're doing an oral fiber optic, right? Yes. So put it in. You can put your entry catheter over it and go down. And it's a skill they need anyway for their unanticipated difficult airway. Put it in and way through it. So I would change I've changed to a different technique. And now that we've these nice VLs, we've got McGraths, they're very nice. You can use those. But I would stress that you need a little bit more analgesia in the airway to do an, and I don't think this has been said enough, to do an awake VL.
Yep.
So it's easier. It's easier because we're used to VLs, but actually there's more traction in the airway and it's more uncomfortable for the patient than in a wake fiber optic. So,
Absolutely. So
we would do, but then I would do, which I didn't talk about when I was talking about local, I forgot to say, I do use a transtracheal approach in the kind of max fax patients, particularly the big max fax guys, particularly if you want to do a wake VL. 4 mils of 4% into your trachea with a little cannula is just works so well.
Yeah. Yes.
And probably as time goes on, I'm using it a little bit more actually because the analgesia is just perfect. Because I do spray as you go with an epidural catheter as well, which I never mentioned earlier.
Okay.
Not for the larynx, because Remy really stops the laryngeal reflex when you're the coughing. But when you go past the larynx,
yeah,
that's when, if you go too far down towards the carina, you can cause a bit of coughing. So that's where I put the local with my epidural.
Absolutely. I teach that I spray on 3 points, on epiglottis, on vocal cords, and definitely on carina, because if you inadvertently put the scope or the tube a little bit too far down, and you touch the carina, they will cough like mad. And there were cases among some colleagues where they coughed the tube out after it's been put in. So after wrapping it all up, what would be your tip for the successful fiber optic intubation?
My tip for successful is good preparation. Have your checklist. Cooperative patient, because you have discussed it with them. You don't just wheel them into theatre. Discuss it with them. Get the cooperation of the patient. That will help. And then topicalization is so essential. Oxygenation, and then your procedure, which you can practice, you can train on. So there are really 4 elements. Sedation is not the most important thing. Topicalization is, oxygenation is, and then, you know, nice procedure. So you've trained on the Orsim, or you've trained on a mannequin. Just get used to using the scope. And try, I mean, when I started, you know, there weren't that many people to teach you, although I had the wonderful Peter Charters in Liverpool when I started. But you must just do it on the easier patients, you know. I'm not saying you're using the patients, but there are indications. If, you know, lots of patients are anticipated difficult airways, but you must do it on those patients. And start asleep through your LMA. Start asleep. Just take the scope out and practice and do it on your patients. And that's interesting because there's an ethics guideline coming out from the Difficult Airway Society. And is it ethical to do that? But I think it is. You're not causing the patient any harm and you're just putting the scope down to put your tube in, and it won't cause any morbidity to the patients.
Yeah.
So practice.
Yeah, yeah. I quite often, you know, put an LMA in, they put the scope through the LMA. It's so much easier. It just leads you straight to the larynx. And you think, okay, in the anticipated airway scenario, I can do that with an entry catheter, which they all have to learn. And I've done it on the real difficult case.
Yeah.
And then thank you very much for being with us here today. And I really myself enjoyed the discussion and exchanging the views. And thank you for all the listeners to listen into this episode. Just a reminder to you all that Isaic releases monthly podcasts on the Isaic website and various streaming platforms. And we hope you will join us. We will join us for the next video podcast. Thank you very much, Ellen.